Hello, welcome to the House of Commons podcast. This is a regular podcast about politics where we talk about what's happened in the week just gone. I am Mark Thompson. I used to be a Lib Dem blogger, but I am now an independent blogger. And joining me is my regular co-host, Emma Burnell, who is a Labour blogger who blogs at Scarlet Standard. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, and also we're delighted to be joined by Nick Dennis, who is... Do you know what? I've completely forgotten how to introduce you, Nick.
That's all right. I'm about to found a website called www.hasmarkjoinedthenationalliberalsyet.com. So if everyone wants to follow my work on that. And I'm also a co-editor of Platform 10, which is a liberal conservative, big society loving, modernising, proud Tory blog. So I think that's where you first met me.
Yeah, I knew it was Platform 10. I just couldn't quite remember what your capacity was. So there we go. And thanks for the little... little nudge about the whole liberal thing.
Well, I just thought it was really nice that after, obviously, I listened to last week's podcast where you talked about why you left the Lib Dems, and I thought it was really nice that Nick Bowles decided to set up a new party for you. I think what the Tories are all about nowadays. Yeah. That's what modernising inclusive Tourism is all about.
Yeah. It's not often when someone leaves a party and someone else decides to set up another party precisely for those people. So there you go. Just before we start, actually, it's Doctor Who 50th anniversary weekend. Emma, I believe you watched it last night. Well, what did you think?
Oh, I loved it. It was schmaltzy and all the things that the real fanboys hate, so I really, really liked it.
What do you mean the real fanboys hate?
Oh, they don't like emotion in Doctor Who, and there was quite a lot of emotion, and girls, and snogging, and David Tennant.
But there was loads of kind of fanboy nods as well. I mean,
I love nods. Don't get me wrong. I love nods. Like one of my favourite things about Buffy is the amount of references back. But what I also like good plot line and drama and romance. And so I like Doctor Who that can do both. And that was that in spades.
I did like the bit where I can't remember the exact line, but when Matt Smith said something like, "Watch it, Dick Van Dyke," to David Tennant, which wasn't even anything to do with Doctor Who. That was just basically him saying, "Your English accent isn't very good," to the actor. I thought it was okay. I thought the storyline slightly fell apart towards the end, to be honest. And the fact that they also had Peter Capaldi in, I mean, again, that was nice to just see his eyes and see, you know, but that had nothing to do with the storyline at all. I thought it was quite good. The reason I've not asked Nick, just in case listeners are wondering, is because Nick doesn't like Doctor Who. He's one of those people. So
I've decided this is worse than being a Tory.
Well, but if whilst I'd still been a member of the Lib Dems, I'd have said that, I'd have probably been kicked out of the party, because there seems to be this very, very strong link between Doctor Who and Lib Dems. I don't quite understand why, but it does.
Most of the actors have been in Labour PPPs at one point or another. It's quite interesting.
That's true.
If there were an election in Gallifrey, we'd definitely win.
Well, just before we move on, actually, Emma, who is your favourite Doctor out of the 12 that we've now had?
Joint favourites, Doctor Who and Peter Davison. Sorry, Doctor Who and Peter Davison. David Tennant and Peter Davison.
I love the way you call him Doctor Who as if that's his actual name. funnily enough, Peter Davison was the one I grew up with, so I would say Peter Davison, actually. But I do really think David Tennant was fantastic as well. I've got high hopes for Peter Capaldi, though, so watch this space. Nick, even though you don't really watch it, by osmosis, do you have one? A favourite?
Well, I'm looking forward to the J.J. Abrahams film version of Doctor Who, which I think I will really enjoy when he does that.
Right.
So like he's taken Star Trek, which I used to really dislike, but really like the film. So I'm just waiting for that. Okay. Tom Baker is fantastic, just in general. I'd watch Tom Baker being Tom Baker in anything. I'm sorry, I've never really watched Doctor Who ever, I'm afraid. So I'm happy that you guys are happy.
Well, I presume we're not breaking any news story here that I've not suddenly inexplicably not been aware of. You're just assuming at some point J.J. Abrams will do a reboot.
No, well, he does. That's what he seems to do with old sort of sci-fi popular franchises. So I assume Doctor Who will be next on his list. It's not an exclusive. It's just an assumption.
Yeah. Well, they go terribly well when they try to make films of Doctor Who.
No, that's true.
Doesn't go that well. Okay, anyway. People generally don't listen to this podcast for Doctor Who banter, so maybe we should move on. A few things we're going to cover this week. The first thing we wanted to cover was the whole debacle, I don't even know what to call it really, around Paul Flowers, who until fairly recently was he CEO of Co-op Bank?
Chairman of the board,
there we go. And he gave some evidence to select committee a little while ago, and he clearly didn't have a clue what was going on. He thought his bank's assets were worth $3 billion. They're actually worth $47 billion. He just didn't seem to know how to run a bank at all. And since then, things have escalated. He was filmed by journalists, apparently, allegedly, buying Class A drugs. I think it was cocaine and crystal meth. So we have to say allegedly, because I think there might be a court case pending for that. But that certainly seemed to be what was happening. And also there were question marks over something to do with pornography on his laptop. And actually, he had to stand down from a council position a couple of years ago because of that. And the reason it's really rocketed into the political sphere in the last few days is because at PMQs, David Cameron decided to really go in hard about Flowers and try to draw a very strong link between the Labour polls and Paul Flowers. Apparently he was an advisor in some capacity. And of course, the Co-op Bank does have close links with the Labour Party. So, Emma, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think it was fair game for Cameron to do what he did at PMQs?
No, not what he did. I think if he just, like, you know, made a few cracks about it, that would have been par for the course. It's not always a good course, but it probably would have been par for it. The government using their governmental muscle to launch an investigation, which is so clearly partisan, when there are already investigations happening by the regulator into this specific bank, I think that's really, really worrying and really, really a bad precedent. I mean, there's been all sorts of trying to tie Ed Miliband, and particularly Ed Balls, because Ed Balls is a cooperative MP as well as a Labour MP.
Don't forget the 50,000 as well, Emma.
And has had donations from Paul Flowers. Was it directly from Paul Flowers or was it from the co-op?
No, it was from the some sort of part of the co-op group which he sat on, or one of the other boards or something. So,
well,
it wasn't directly from
I think there's been, you know, attempts to tie both of them to this clearly quite bonkers man. But it just all feels a bit like I would get the everyday politicking of the tawdry, hey, Ed Miliband's probably a meth head too. Although anyone who listens to Desert Islandist today would find that hard to believe. Bless him. If you listen to Aha and Sweet Caroline, you're not a meth head. You probably never even heard of rock and roll. But to take it to an investigation seems to me to be taking an Americanized really step too far in terms of partisan behavior.
Nick, what do you think about this?
There definitely needs to be investigations into what happened. I read today in the Sunday Times that there might be 7 investigations, and I agree that seems too many. I don't think there should be 7 investigations. But what happened was absolutely terrible. You have this bank, which is part of a very trusted brand. I mean, lots of the people who are co-op members because they believe in the philosophy of the co-op, not just that it's just any other business. And it's disgraceful that the way that the bank behave. It was incompetent. It was greedy. There was hubris. I mean, it's like they didn't get the memo from 2008 about the crash. They did all the things that people like RBS did. They went in and got tried to do a merger with Britannia, and then found out once that had happened that Britannia's loan book was really bad, and that helped bring them down. Then they tried to expand by getting branches of Lloyds, which they couldn't afford. And I read somewhere in the paper today that they saw the 2008 crash as a chance to expand. And it sounds like just complete arrogance that they believe that because of their ethics, which I admire greatly cooperatism and cooperative ethics, that they go beyond this. So something really terribly bad has gone wrong. And, you know, there's 7 million people who bank with the co-op. And obviously their most important thing is their money, and that their money is protected. So for the first question, yes, definitely there should be some independent inquiries. I had a look around on the internet today just to sort of see what these inquiries were. And I couldn't I think what might have happened is that PMQs, the language that David Cameron used, was very political. But I, as far as I'm aware, George Osborne is asking the regulator, the Prudential Regulation Authority, to carry out an independent investigation. And the Treasury Select Committee, which is not technically linked to the government, which has but has a Conservative chair and Andrew Tyrie, are going to do an investigation into whether the regulator was culpable or not. Now, I'm not sure there is a separate political inquiry going on. I couldn't find any details of any specific political inquiry, so I don't think it's government using their muscle to do an inquiry which is biased. But I do think the language that David Cameron used on Wednesday was very political, when it probably, well, in the PMQ's context was probably okay, but in the external context probably wasn't actually accurate. I mean, that's my understanding of the inquiry anyway.
So you think it's fair enough for Cameron to say what he said and to try and draw a very, very strong link? And you know, even the fact that he's saying the name Paul Flowers and he's trying to make it very, very clear that Flowers was an advisor. I mean, I don't even know in what capacity he was supposed to have been advising the Labour leader. I mean, I would imagine there are dozens, maybe hundreds of people who could be pointed at and said, you have been or are a Labour advisor. And do you think it's fair for him to do that?
Yeah, he wasn't a spaz. He was on a committee of people who met very, very infrequently to talk about banking policy.
Actually, Nick, what it reminded me of, because this used to drive me nuts, was when Gordon Brown used to jab his finger at David Cameron and talk about the Black Wednesday in 1993, as if Cameron was somehow responsible for what happened on Black Wednesday, when he was, you know, just a junior special advisor to Norman Lamont. You're not feeling there's a bit of an echo of that sort of thing? It's kind of smear guilt by association thing.
Well, I think, I mean, like yourself, I'm not a massive fan of Prime Minister's Question Times anyway, and I think he gets overly political. And I do think part of what David Cameron was doing on Wednesday was the very much sort of, if somebody chucks mud at one person, he was chucking mud back. So, I'm not sure that the Paul Flowers thing will last in terms of trying to associate Labour directly in. He was a special advisor advising on Labour economic policy, because I don't think he was. And trying to translate Paul Flowers as a living embodiment of Labour economic policy, I think is a far stretch. But I think where it will come up in the future is when Labour will throw mud at us over something or other. I mean, if you looked at the exchange at PMQs, I mean, David Cameron brought it up after Ed Miliband threw some mud regarding what Nick Bowles said. So I think it'll be used as sort of a defensive tactic. But, and this is a big, big but, the politics of this should be looked into. I mean, there is a close link between the Co-op group and the Labour group. 32 MPs are Co-op Labour, and of course Ed Bowles is the highest one. Over the last 10 years, the Co-op movement has given £6.5 million to Labour and the Co-op Labour Party. Also, the Co-op Bank has given Labour £18 million of soft loans. And I do wonder if things weren't checked out properly by the regulator because of the close political connections, and regulators don't like getting involved in politics. So I think there is something to look in there about why this happened and whether there were any issues with the link to being close to politics.
Emma?
I think that there is no problem with Labour and the cooperative movement being close together. They developed together, they grew up together. If what has happened is the regulator has said, oh, they're a bit too close to a political party, we better not look at that. That is the regulator being an idiot and shouldn't happen. But I would be really shocked if that did happen, because that's not a regulator's job. A regulator's job is to look at everybody scrupulously and fairly and equally.
Emma, though, how do you feel, though, about what seems to have happened here is that Paul Flowers was able to use the kind of political structure and political mechanisms that are in place in and around the Co-op movement in order to facilitate his rise up the ranks to get to the position that he was in? Do you not think that perhaps there are questions to be answered? I mean, I personally feel the way Cameron handled things at PMQs this week, you won't be surprised to hear after my comments last week, and one of the reasons why I left the Dems to, you know, remove myself from the main parties, I thought he was disgusting. You know, he shouldn't be saying stuff in the way that he said it. But that doesn't necessarily mean I don't think there are some questions to be answered here.
Of course there are questions to be answered. Paul Flower should never have, clearly have never been in that role.
Okay, so...
And the process that put him in that role needs questioning and scrutiny. Okay. That does not mean, oh my God, the co-op should withdraw from anything to do with Labour. It's about making sure that that works better rather than, and works properly, rather than saying it's all a mess, let's just leave it completely alone.
Okay, but what do you think needs to happen? I mean, do you think there needs to be a political inquiry specifically with reference to that, and if so, how should that happen?
I think
should it be left to the Labour Party?
Inquiry, as Nick says, into how the regulator works. I think there needs to be an inquiry into whether there was a regulatory failure. I think they need that inquiry should cover how the chair of the cooperative bank is appointed and what the job description and how that is matched at interview is done, and make sure that that is done in the right way. But it's not, I wouldn't want to see that done as a political inquiry, because if you have something that is a political inquiry, you automatically have partisanship in it.
I didn't mean a political inquiry. What I meant was an inquiry into the structure of the political nature of whatever happened and how it was allowed to happen.
No, and I actually the whole nature of what happened, which includes the political bodies as part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually wonder if what's needed here is an internal inquiry, either by the Labour Party or by the co-op movement itself.
I think the co-op movement itself is one of those seven inquiries, so that right. will definitely happen. I mean, for me, the three basic questions that need answering, first of all, is why was he in that position? Who knew what when? And why did no one do anything? And I think once you know the answer to those, then you can sort of follow that line forward. Because the co-op group have basically £1.5 billion hole in their balance sheet. Now, that's scary. I mean, so you talk about these massive sums of money now with all the financial crisis. But that any sort of talk about them in a very blasé way. But that's quite a scary thing. And interestingly, noting Emma's point, talking about cooperative movement and Labour Party, which, of course, you know, that they should not be, you know, they should not be split up because of this. It's up to them what happens. But the new owners of the co-op bank are some American hedge funds who gave $100,000 to the Republicans at last election, which I thought was quite an ironic thing. But I don't know what's going to happen to the co-op bank, because is it still going to be a cooperative bank as well? But anyway, that's another question. No,
but I think that's the saddest part of all, is that people who allowed this to happen, whether it was the political people or the banking people, have destroyed a once great institution, and now there isn't that. You know, it's very likely that there won't be a cooperative bank that is a cooperative.
And also, let's not
the actual way of working.
I mean, let's not forget, this is actually not about just Peter Flowers, because Peter Flowers, as chair, as the board oversees the strategy and it asks awkward questions at the right time.
Absolutely.
To make sure things are going well. But there's yeah, indeed. So obviously Peter Flowers, because
Paul,
he's an extravagant person.
Paul Flowers, you want to be careful in case there's anyone called Peter Flowers.
Yes, but because Paul Flowers is an extravagant person, and he got caught by a Sunday newspaper in a sort of a sexy sting, shall we say, that a lot of focus is on him. But I think the focus should be on where the real problems are. And I don't think really he will be the real problem.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, it feels to me like this is becoming a witch hunt. In the last few mm-hmm. days, the way he's being talked about, and he's being painted as this complete bogeyman. And actually, I'm starting to get echoes of what happened with David Kelly. I really hope he doesn't go down that road because, you know, that was horrendous. But, you know, a person who really, you know, is just suddenly finds themselves at the centre of political debate in such an intense way, you know, I really just, and he, you know, he's clearly got problems as well. He needs to just be left to sort himself out, and he needs help, frankly, not this. You know, I agree that there needs to be, you know, inquiries and all the rest of it, but it shouldn't be personality focused. It should be on the structures, certainly. Okay. Well, maybe we'll move on to some comments that the Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, made this week, which were reported, I think it was in an interview with Benedict Brogan in The Telegraph, where he talked about how, I haven't actually got the quote in front of me, so correct me if I get this wrong, but it was something along the lines of Although he is very much in favour of immigration and it's been very good for our country, his concern is that in some cases you get people from, he described as, I think, South Asian countries, who come from a culture where there's a kind of favour culture that operates, and that he thinks that that's actually really bad for this country, and that, that those people need to understand that's not how things work here. And then when he was pressed specifically, I think Brogan asked him if he meant Pakistani immigrants, and he responded yes to that. This has now blown up. It's caused quite a lot of controversy, unsurprisingly, really. I mean, you know, comments like this always do cause problems, and he has apologised. I think I read a piece today, someone saying that really he shouldn't have had to apologise. Nick, what do you think about this? Do you think that, that Grieve was right to say what he said?
Just interestingly, before I came onto this programme, I had a quick look at Transparency International Index, and Pakistan is the 139th most corrupt country in the world out of 174, and Bangladesh is the 144th most corrupt country, and the UK is at number 17. So to say that Pakistan and Bangladesh are corrupt countries, I think, is there in fact. What I would say is that Dominic Grieve is a lawyer's politician. He's not a populist. If Nigel Farage, for instance, would have said something similar, it would have had a different connotation, a different meaning, a different reasoning behind it. He would have been saying it in order to, try and get votes more than anything else. But I think what Dominic, and I read the interview, and it was a long interview and covered many, many different subjects, including, his belief in the rule of law. For instance, it was Dominic Grieve who put his foot down and said Abu Qatar can't be deported before we go through the international courts. So this is somebody who is really interested in the rule of law. So I agree with the interview. What I don't necessarily agree with, and I think was a misinterpretation of what he said, was the front page Telegraph headline, which was "Minister, corruption is rife in the Pakistani community," which when you read the full page interview, actually isn't as blatant as he was talking about.
Okay, but I mean, he's a big boy. He's been around a long time. He must have known how things would be reported and would be covered. So I mean, do you think?
Yeah.
Did you think it was fair for him to say what he said?
100% yes, because if there are issues, you should talk about them. And I think, you know, I think there are issues here. And saying that there are issues is not the same as saying that the whole community is corrupt, which is where the headline came out of. I mean, I cut my political teeth in Tower Hamlets. I lived in Tower Hamlets between 2005 and 2008, and I was a minority in Tower Hamlets, being a Conservative. But one of the great things about being in a political party is it gets you out of your comfort zone, and you go and go down streets that you wouldn't normally go down, knock on doors, and interact with the community. And so, you know, a lot of people like me who lived in Mile End at the time, you know, were sort of working in the city, but you really commuting and not being part of the community. But through being involved in politics in Tower Hamlets at that time, I saw epic corruption, which made me angry. And that was within the Bangladeshi community that was there. And it was sort of, I mean, when I talk about corruption, you know, small two-bedroom houses with 10 people in the electoral roll who vote, blocks of estates, which all vote in the same way by postal vote, intimidation at polling stations, which loads of people around the polling stations, sometimes, you know, trying to turn away women voters because they're not modestly enough dressed. Basically, turning up to vote and finding out that they're already voted, apparently, but nobody doing anything about this in this area. And one of the things that I think was really disturbing at the time is I think no one really wanted to do anything about it because they were scared of being called racist if they went in and tried to do something about it. So I've seen corruption happening within an area which has a strong South Asian population, but I have to say I don't necessarily think that means that all areas like that are corrupt. I've seen it, and what annoyed me the most is that no one came in and wanted to sort it out.
Emma, what do you think? Have you experienced that sort of thing that Nick's talking about,
the favor system? Yeah. Imagine if, like, say, I know most of our judges, large amounts of our senior politicians, all our QCs all went to the same schools and universities and all knew each other from a very, very young age. Perhaps we're able to help each other out in certain unspoken ways. Maybe we could have a situation where someone in the head of state's employment could ring up and get someone a job at Central Office, Central Conservative Office, and give them that start in life that they truly deserve. It's just a little favour for a mate. Can you imagine how that might work in a democracy?
Okay, so point taken. Yeah, you know, handshakes and old boys networks and all the rest of it. We know that that goes on, but the specific thing that Grieve was talking about.
Why is it different just because they're Asian?
Oh, why, I think two wrongs.
Why are we talking about these small amounts of power that these people are corrupt and not the massive overarching amounts of power that is not corruption, it's just the establishment?
I mean, that's just crazy. Two wrongs don't make a right.
Why is it crazy?
Because two wrongs don't make a right. That's why it's crazy.
But why aren't we talking about the corruption that is the old boys network?
Okay, well, to be fair, Emma, we have talked about that sort of thing on this podcast before, and it's the sort of thing that I hate. I hate the fact that, you know, something like a third of MPs went to private school when only 7% of the population of the country do, and, you know, two thirds of the cabinet did, and all the rest of it. It's terrible. But this is just whataboutery. You know,
it is. We've got an attorney general who's saying there's this terrible corruption in this country, and he is a beneficiary of exactly the same kind of corruption.
I'll do a slight deal, Emma. When we move on to talk about Nick Bowles, I think that's a good time to bring up elitism and the new or the failure of the new Tory party or whatever. But I don't dismiss the things you're saying about social mobility and those type of things. But I think I don't think what I saw in Tower Hamlets made me angry. Because
does that not make you angry, Emma?
Because it makes me
furious.
Please, yes, of course it makes me angry. I know people who working very, very hard to this day in Tower Hamlets trying to overcome this. And actually, Tower Hamlets has come a very, very long way. It's still very, very difficult. Look for Rahman is a very difficult character and very hard to work around. But yes, of course it makes me furious. But what we are doing is focusing on corruption at the lowest level and completely closing our eyes to corruption that's all around us. And that also makes me furious. And that needs far more investigation than we're currently giving it.
Well, are we closing our eyes to corruption all around us? Because I seem to recall the whole question about internships and the fact that that's damaging to social mobility. That's really been very high in the political agenda in the last few months.
I don't want to move away from the main point of this. I mean, the internship thing is very important, but for people on the ground within who live and operate within Tower Hamlets, it's a big deal. I mean, Peter Gold's leader of the Conservative group, who's a homosexual, gets heckled all the time. You know, one of the tactics that's used is the galleries are filled up with people who basically then shout gay and Jewish slurs at him. I mean, the Jewish slur was used against Una King when she lost her seat. You know, Peter Golds, I've heard him being called Mrs. Golds and being criticised for unnatural acts. Female Labour councillors from the Muslim community basically standing down because they're intimidated because apparently they weren't Islamic enough. So there are some real, you know, people within that area are affected by these issues in a real bad way.
I'm not denying any of that. And if you want, Mark, we can invite my very good friend who is a Tower Hamlets councillor and also happens to be gay onto the podcast if you'd like. Or I can another Tower Hamlets councillor who's a good friend who's a woman. Both of those, I'd be happy to bring them on. We can have a Tower Hamlets special. But the thing is that we are extrapolating from one situation into an entire community of British Pakistanis, which is what Dominic Grieve has done. And that is not right. That's not fair. That is unjust.
Isn't it fair to say, though, Emma, that actually that isn't what Grieve said? What he said was there are sometimes problems in some areas of that community. And it was the headline writers and the way they wrote it.
He didn't say some areas of that community. He said within that community.
Okay, but he didn't say it was all of them.
Just Bradford.
He didn't say it was all of them.
Well, okay, I like most blacks. You know, that's still a racist statement, isn't it?
Well, you think what he said was racist?
Yes.
Why?
I think because what he was doing was narrowly focusing on an ethnicity rather than an issue.
Well, he did seem to go out of his way afterwards to say that it isn't just that community and corruption occurs across all communities. It's just that he thinks there's
Then why name that one?
Because he said there's a particular specific problem to do with the favour culture that is endemic in that community.
Well,
because that's what happens.
That's the only community with a favour problem, as I may have made clear earlier.
He didn't say it was the only community that has that problem. He said it's a particular problem in that community. It sounds, Emma, like you just don't want this to be discussed.
I don't mind discussing it at all, as I have offered to bring on two guests to discuss it for an hour.
Yeah, well, maybe
I'd listen to that show.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a good idea. Maybe we'll do that.
Fine. I
think it's a very good issue. But,
okay. All right. Well, I'm not sure there's much else to say on this then. I mean, you know, I was slightly digressing into, you know, the whole thing about interns, but that will probably send us off on a different tangent. My point was just that, Emma, you said that, you know, we never talk about that stuff. Yes, we do.
It does. We don't talk about it, Mark. We talk about it. We don't deal with it. Nothing's happening. Nothing's changing. Nothing's getting better. It's getting worse.
I don't think the whole intern thing does seem to be changing. That's a small part of the corruption of the status quo.
The interns changing will make the huge difference to the fact that nearly all of our judges are privately educated.
Yeah. So, you know, and I'm not happy about that either. And, you know, that's like a mountain that you've got to move. But, you know, you've got to start with small steps. You know, that's how these things eventually change. So something like the complete lack of social mobility that you have with the current or previous intern system, that's the sort of thing that slowly, incrementally over time can help. So you can't just completely dismiss it. My point is...
I'm not dismissing it. You're putting a lot of words in my mouth tonight, Mark.
Well, I don't intend to. But it does feel like you don't particularly want to talk about one thing and you just rather talk about something completely different.
Well, as I've, for the third time, if you want to talk about it now, I'll talk about it now. I don't live in Tower Hamlets. I don't live in an area that's predominantly Pakistani. I haven't experienced these issues. I will bring people on who do live there now who will be happy to talk about it. I can't speak from experience, but I can say that as far as where I have lived, where there have been Pakistani people, as well as a vast majority of other people, I have not experienced this kind of favour system from them. There have been other areas where the favour system has come in. I've mentioned one or two tonight. I will happily talk about whatever you want me to talk about. I'm not denying that there's a conversation to be had, and there certainly are definite issues, particularly within Tower Hamlets, and Tower Hamlets politics is very, very difficult. But I'm not saying that I don't want to talk about anything, or that I'm dismissing the movements for making internships fairer as not a good thing. I'm just saying that it's not remotely close to dealing with the very big problem we have of the favour culture at the top of our society. And perhaps we should take the beam from our own eye before trying to remove the moat from our brothers.
Nick, you were going to say something.
I think this is probably worth moving on to what Nick Bowles said, because it's sort of, and the modernization or non-modernization of the Conservative Party, because I think we can definitely wrap some of that stuff into that, because what I was very interesting to read today, that apparently according to James Forsyth's column in the Mail Online, that Linton Crosby has told Cameron and Tory MPs that cost of living isn't really that big an issue for the electorate, and we should concentrate on other things. I know. I was astonished when I read that, but he's obviously, you know, he's a very experienced campaigner who's paid a lot of money for his expertise. And
cost of living is no problem to him then.
Well, I mean, cost of living is certainly not a problem to him, but it seems to be that social mobility, no politician worth voting for or even considering voting for would ever say that social mobility is not important. It seems to me that the Conservative Party is sort of having a conversation with itself again, really, about what sort of party it should be. I think what Emma was talking about sort of ties into that, because I completely agree with her that the way schooling certain schools means you're more likely to have better jobs is not a good thing for our society, really.
Yeah, but I mean, to come specifically to Bowles's comments, I mean, he talked about how he would like to see a revival of the National Liberal Party, which I think was a party that existed in the early to middle part of the 20th century, and which eventually became subsumed into the Conservatives, but had kind of grown out of a split within the Liberal Party in the 1920s, I think. And, and he seemed to think it would be a very good idea if we had something like that happen again, that could be perhaps a natural home for kind of liberal conservatives, people like, I mean, I think he specifically cited Jeremy Brown and David Laws, but I suspect people like yourself as well, Nick, might feel quite at home in a party such as that.
Yeah, except I feel at home inside the Conservative Party, actually. Oh. And I think,
well, you have to say that, don't you, to be fair? I don't have to say stuff like that anymore. It's great.
No, you don't. No, but I do say that because I mean, Nick Bowles asked the right questions and came up with the wrong answer. And one of the things that he definitely got right is that we should be more honest about the internal coalitions. Almost political parties are almost like families, and there will be disagreements, and there will, and that's all fine. That should be out in the open. So, but you know, I'm obviously a member of the Conservative Party, but I'm also, you know, I'm heavily involved with people like Bright Blue, David Skelton's Renewal, do the Platform 10 thing. So I can actually diversify within the Conservative Party and concentrate on issues which I think are important. So being conservative doesn't stop me from actually, shall we say, expressing my pure political views. So Emma, I don't think there's any need for a National Liberal Party.
Emma, what do you think? Because I imagine you'd be delighted with another party kind of taking votes from the Liberals and maybe the Conservatives.
Bring it on. But I think more, because it's not going to happen. Yeah. I think more interestingly is that Nick Bowles seems to have completely given up on it happening under the Conservative brand. And I think this reflects back on a lot of the stuff that we've seen over particularly the last 6 months or so, where all of that work that was done to try and modernise the Conservative Party in opposition just seems to have been completely abandoned. Yeah. The green stuff is gone.
What, green crap?
Green crap, exactly. There you go, we got it in.
Well, that was one of the things we were going to talk about. But, I mean, I think, you know, that you've got a very good point there. And I think, I mean, I've heard it described as, you know, retoxification, where they spent all these years in opposition, Cameron particularly, and those around him, trying to detoxify the Tories. And actually, since having been in government, I think partly as a result of some of the battles with the Lib Dems. So in some ways, they've been able to get to, I think Cameron himself has been able to keep himself positioned kind of in the centre, but mainly because the Lib Dems have kind of dragged him more to the left than if he, let's say they'd got, the Tories had got in with, say, a majority of 10 or 15, he'd have been dragged far further to the right than he'd have liked either. But in order to kind of, you know, shore up the votes, you know, his kind of base vote, it really does feel like, you know, a lot of this stuff that was said in opposition about the green stuff and, you know, also about kind of civil liberties and that just seems to have gone by the wayside. I guess you'd disagree with that, though, Nick, would you? Because you're obviously still in the party. So,
yeah, definitely. I was there at the speech, and it partially felt like an ex-boyfriend getting his own back on a woman who slighted him, because I don't know if Nick Bowles was very, very keen for the coalition, and most of the speech was contained with, well, you weren't what you promised to be, Lib Dems. You let me down.
What was the specific problem?
Basically, you're a bunch, not you obviously, Mark, anymore, but you're a bunch of soft left statists, and you're not really defending freedom or liberty. And,
yeah, but I did hear that bit, and that is incredibly rich, coming from the party as authoritarian. I mean, you know, those go home vans, for example,
yeah,
can't get much more statist and authoritarian than that. And that the Lib Dems didn't even know about that. I mean, there's questions to be answered about why they didn't know. You know, maybe they weren't, you know, on their game properly. But, you know, that was a Tory sponsored initiative. And there's been plenty of examples of that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, definitely. And Nick Bowles wrote a book a couple of months after the coalition was formed, saying that the Lib Dems and the Conservatives should form a permanent coalition, and there should be a coupon election where essentially the Lib Dems and Conservatives don't stand against each other in 2015. Now, because I think what Nick Clegg should do is he should have a copy of Nick Bowles' speech and send it to anyone who ever criticises him for being too close to the Conservatives, because basically what he's saying now is the Lib Dems aren't aren't as, you know, that idealistic utopian grouping just it hasn't happened. It's fault of the Lib Dems. And he almost wants to continue that sort of idea, but with his own Liberal Party, which is a proper centrist Liberal Party. I don't think that works, to be honest. And also, I think the idea that what people want is another political party is completely crackers and goes against the trend of life. People don't want another political party. What people want is a looser association with politics. I mean, the idea that you sign up to a political party who can then speaks on you on a wide variety of views is so alien to the way modern life works. So I think, you know, I think he asked the right questions and he was very perceptive about the internal coalitions and being more honest about the debates. But I think his answer was completely wrong.
Yeah. I mean, Emma, you can call it at about 45 minutes if you like. But the main reason why such a party will not evolve is because of first past the post. Because if that was to happen, then as we know, all...
Can I have a website say, will Mark stop banging on about political bloody change?
You can set up any website you want. Mark going on about electoral reform, surprise, surprise. But that is the truth. If we had an electoral system...
In your opinion, I wouldn't say it's the truth. It's not... you cannot claim something to be the truth without proof. And it's an assertion you can make.
Okay, but I will make an assertion that is definitely true. It is harder for a party like, you know, a putative National Liberal Party to gain any kind of foothold under the current electoral system, and it just makes it less likely to happen.
Well, UKIP's not exactly, you know, old and grey.
They've been around 20 years and they haven't got any MPs. I mean, you know, they might do after the next election, but they might not, even if they got 20%.
They might get an MP. They've got several hundred councillors.
Yeah, but the whole point is that UKIP are an insurgent party that have kind of sprung from nowhere, and they're kind of peeling votes off the right. But the idea that someone who genuinely wanted to see a party, you know, like the Conservatives and the Liberals do well, if you set up a National Liberal Party, you would just be damaging both of those parties.
What Nick Bowles suggested was that the National Liberal Party would stand in seats and the Conservatives wouldn't stand in those seats.
Yeah, so you're back to the kind of coupon election.
Yeah, which would give them a helping hand. But I think your general point, Mark, is apart from whether PR is the answer... Interestingly, while I was listening to Nick Bowles' speech, I thought to myself, well, actually, what you want is AV, isn't it, really? Because then in seats, you could have two different types of Tories. So let's say somewhere like the place where I live now, Ruislip, Northwood and Pinner, which is a very strong Conservative seat. Obviously, the local MP, Nick Hurd, won't thank me for saying this, and he's a very good MP, so I'm not specifically directing at him. But you could have a Conservative and a National Liberal candidate, and basically Conservative voters could be confident with the AV system that one Conservative would win, and then they could make their preference of Conservatives.
Yeah,
and I thought I'm not a massive, you know, PR person or anything like that, but I did think, Mark, when I was listening to the speech, the elephant in the room was he didn't talk about electoral systems.
The problem is
I don't disagree with you. I'm just, you know, we kind of do this ground every week.
Well, I was just going to say, Nick, the problem is that loads of soldiers wouldn't get the bulletproof vest then, and there'd be babies that wouldn't get, you know, life support systems. So we can't have AV, unfortunately. Emma, sorry, did you want to say anything else on this?
No.
Oh, come on. You must want to.
Which is that what Nick Bowles has proved is that the Conservative hasn't changed and is asking whether they're capable of change. And for Nick Bowles, as for myself, I think the answer is no.
I mean, Nick...
I disagree.
Maybe we'll just finish on this, though. Do you not think that's actually a fair point in that he can't really stand on a platform and slag his own party off? So he slagged the Lib Dems off, but he must be equally as disappointed with his own party. He just can't really say that and still, you know, remain in the position that he's in.
Partially, yes. He did mention that there are, you know, some on the right within the Conservative Party who basically aren't comfortable with modern Britain, and they're, you know, that they should basically wake up to that. So he did criticise those, shall we say, the Peter Bones, the Mark Recklesses, all those sort of people. I disagree with Emma on the main point, and you know, I mean, obviously. Emma will never, I don't think, ever come round to us, no matter how much we modernise or what we do. But I think the Conservatives, there are many, many strong voices in the Conservative movement which are, you know, taking seriously, you know, social mobility, inclusiveness, and, you know, realising these are important issues that we want to deal with. So I think the Conservative Party is basically where the British public is, and I think it's evolving in the right way, actually. I think Nick Bowles might be, you know, he might have been a bit depressed partially when he was making his speech, but I think the future is actually looking quite good for the Conservative Party.
Okay, well, I did say I'd give you the last word, so I won't try and contradict what you just said. Okay, well, it's probably just about time to wrap things up there. So I'd just like to thank, as usual, Emma for being my co-host.
Cheers.
And I'd also like to thank Nick Dennis for your time tonight, Nick. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to thank Stephen Moffat for writing the episode of Doctor Who that we all enjoyed last night. And I'd like
and
to
David
thank
David Tennant and Matt Smith.
And David Tennant and Matt Smith. And John Hurt. And
I'm thinking about
David
football.
In order, just to really piss Nick off.
And I'd particularly like to thank Jenna Coleman for existing. And I'd also like to thank Audio Boo.
You used to be in Emmerdale, you know.
I know. I didn't used to watch it. I'd like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back next week.